It's 1 p.m. and welcome to this, the 8th broadcast of Radio Free Erica. Today is my final broadcast, although tomorrow Misha Sklar and Zhenya Plechkina will be broadcasting both in English and in Russian. I'll talk a little bit about that. I'll talk about it now. They're going to be talking to a few people in Russia, asking them to sort of give an outside looking in perspective on the elections, the Republican National Convention, and then also just what their primary concerns are in St. Petersburg and Moscow, where they are located. They will also be doing some readings in Russian, but they will all be providing English translations and quotations and explanations. So join them tomorrow. It should be a good show. Today, on today's show, we're going to pretty soon call Maki Fukuoka in Japan, in Tokyo, to again get that outsider's perspective looking in, also just to hear what the weather's like in Tokyo right now and what's growing there now, and to check in with Maki. She's been kind enough to stay up. It's almost 2 o'clock in the morning there now, so she's staying up so we can have this chat. And then after we talk to Maki, we'll check in again with Wade's daily commute. His commute from Greenpoint, Brooklyn to FIT. We will be talking to the artist Carrie Moyer about her painting in the exhibition here at Schroeder Romero, from where I'm broadcasting today. And after we speak to Carrie, we'll talk to Ricardo Dominguez about his web project that's happening in conjunction with the Watch What We Say exhibition, and we will probably end up running a little bit late, and we will talk to the artist Carla Rapice, who just came in. She finished her performance that was happening in conjunction with the exhibition. She was today at Union Square, so we'll get some information about how that went. We're also going to try very hard to fit our daily conversation in with Mary Adams. She's also been providing insights into what she's been seeing and hearing as she does her daily walk from Chelsea to the Lower East Side to her dress shop she's had there for about 20 years. So we very much want to talk to Mary today because I didn't get a chance to check in with her yesterday. So wherever there's moments, we'll fit her in. So now, to call Maki is a complicated endeavor from the gallery, as I am on the landline and I'm calling from my cell phone, and I'm sure you don't want to know, as I don't want to know, what it might cost to call Japan on cell phone. So I've got a phone card here that could take... See how this works. I'm not actually hearing anything. And now my phone is deciding that it's difficult to get a signal here. I guess while this is working on happening, I'd like to again thank Carol for taking care of Dove so that the show can happen on a regular basis, although he is today with his father, but he was with her earlier this
week. Welcome to the New York Alliance card.
All right.
Please enter your PIN number. You have $5 remaining. Please enter the telephone number you wish to dial now.
All right.
You have 3 hours, 15 minutes remaining for this call.
All right, I hope everybody's ready for a 3 hour, 15 minute conversation.
Hi, Ms. Washi.
Maki?
Yeah.
Hi, it's Erica.
Oh, hi, Erica.
Hi. Who else would be calling you at 2 o'clock in the morning?
No. I thought you were calling me yesterday, so I was like, oh, okay.
I'm sorry. Did I wake you?
No, I'm up. I'm drinking this coffee from Tanzania.
Oh, my goodness.
Called Afri Cafe.
It's called Afri.
It's very suspicious.
Afri, like an ape? That's what an ape is in German.
Oh, yeah? Mm. It's ape coffee, yeah.
So, what's the weather like in Tokyo?
Oh, well, we had a huge typhoon just 2 days ago.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it was so big. The whole country could fit inside of it.
Oh my goodness! And so, I don't know that I've ever experienced a typhoon. Like, what does that mean?
Oh, it's pretty exciting.
Are you being funny?
No. There's a lot of rain.
Uh huh.
And thunder. And lightning.
Uh huh.
But what's best about typhoon is that the day after the typhoon,
uh huh,
it's totally clear. And, like, most enjoyable, I don't know, temperature and the humidity. So, you know, typhoon is not so good, but there's always a day after typhoon, too.
Right. So yesterday was beautiful then, because it was the day after.
Yes, I did all my laundry. Yeah.
Because otherwise it's really humid?
Yeah, it's really, really humid.
Oh, wow.
It's unbearable, yeah.
And how long does that last?
Well, the summer is really humid here.
Mm-hmm.
And when typhoon comes, like 2 days before typhoon hits the land, and then during the typhoon, it's like maybe like, what, like 70%, 80% humidity.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And, but then when does the weather start to break? Like mid-September or?
Late September.
Late September.
Yeah.
I don't even really know, like, where Tokyo is in, like, what is it, latitudinally, like, from here? Are we kind of similar, you know?
I think we are a little south of New York.
Uh-huh.
In terms of that. I used to know these things, but of course I've forgotten.
Right.
But Chicago,
uh-huh,
remember how cold it gets in Chicago?
Yes.
Chicago was the same longitude, is it? Like the height?
Right.
As the northern part of Japan. So, how far down is New York from Chicago, do you know?
You know, I don't know. I don't know. That's a good question.
Do you want to use your lifeline?
Exactly, yes, please. I'm on a dial-up or else I would, like, start looking this stuff up on the internet, but I'm afraid to open too many things. I'm afraid I'll crash our connection.
How are you?
I'm okay, I'm good.
Yeah?
I'm good. It's exciting to be talking to you on the telephone.
Yeah, we don't get to do that too often.
Never since we've been in the same city. So what's going on in terms of, like, what's growing around you now? Do you guys have a garden?
Yeah, we have a garden.
You do?
Yeah, it's a very small garden.
What's growing in it right now?
A lot of weed.
Oh.
I just sort of, like, forgot about the yard for a while, so. But I did try to grow some things, and then, like, we have a lot of crows
uh-huh.
in the city, and they just come and pick up all the sprouts.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah.
And so how do you deal with that if you want the sprouts to be able to take real root?
Well, people get really clever, but the thing is, crows are much, much smarter than people.
Right. Well, I mean, so, like, that's all they have to do all day is figure out how to get food.
Right. So, like, you know, there was a classic CD. Like, you hang the CD and it just flashes them or something.
Oh.
And then you can, some people put knit over
uh-huh.
the frames. And there's this thing called bamboo vinegar.
Wow.
It's some ancient oriental thing.
Uh-huh. It sounds like it.
That, it's medicinal, but you can also use it to, like, as a repellent for plants.
Huh. Oh, because so, animals don't like the taste of it.
Yeah, and it smells really awful, too.
Oh. You don't want to put it on your
and it's, you know, it's supposedly all organic, so
right.
the vegetables won't get hurt.
Right.
Yeah. So I've tried with, experiment with that for a while, but, yeah. But do you guys have crow problems there?
You know, I've heard people complain about starlings. They're these birds that are here with roof gardens and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
But where we live, we haven't really had that problem.
Yeah.
So I think it's more like people who have, like, the random roof garden because it's the only oasis for the birds, and
mm-hmm.
so they pick it clean.
Mm-hmm.
But,
And they don't have anything to think about, right?
Exactly, except where to get their next meal.
Yeah.
So, are people talking about it, all the elections coming up? Over
yeah, the Republican convention is all over the news today.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, and yesterday, too. So, yeah, I don't have a newspaper here because
uh-huh.
it's kind of costly, so I just watch TV and surf the internet.
Uh-huh.
But what did I see today on TV about that? Oh, I saw the demonstrations. And I heard that 490 people got arrested or something.
Oh, you know, I haven't even heard numbers of how many people were arrested.
Yeah, and it was kind of funny because yesterday the reports were like, there was no arrest, it was all peaceful.
Right.
And today it was like, yeah.
Oh, maybe that's the total since, like, everything has started.
Yeah, it could be, yeah.
That makes a little more sense. Right.
So there was that, and then they would switch to the convention center, and usually the reports and different channels, they all start by saying, there's a huge gap between what's going on inside and outside.
Right.
So.
Well, that's interesting. I wonder if similar things are being said here in that way, you know, or if just a particular... Hi, Paco Rodriguez. Or if particular... I'm curious. I'm curious if... I haven't seen any television broadcasts, so I'm curious if things like that
yeah.
have been said.
Yeah.
It's like a cliche there now?
I guess that even with the Democrats' convention, too, there's it just looks really ridiculously festive.
Uh-huh.
All these conventions.
Yeah.
So, a lot of reporters comment on, like, you know, this country is in a war.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of cheerleading here, but...
So, are they critical? Are the reports critical?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, they're very critical.
Oh.
And I think, like, even, like, the most conservative news channels... I think they have to be critical because there's so much at stake for Japan.
Right.
You know, in terms of what would happen with the election in America. So they got to figure out, you know, where the Japanese politics is going in relation to that. So.
Right. And
yeah.
And so what do people talk about? That, like, what would the differences be between one or the other candidate?
They don't really talk about that per se. They mention polls,
mm-hmm. Polls meaning polls of Japanese people? Or?
No, in America.
Uh-huh.
And then they would talk about, like in terms of conventions, they'll talk about what each secret said.
Mm-hmm.
And like today, just the fact that Miss America or something came to talk.
At the Republican convention?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Because she's some kind of, like, fundamental Christian and, like...
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So that gets, like, all, like, oh, my God.
Right.
Because she believes in, like, no sex and da-da-da-da. She's, you know, she goes to Harvard and then she's at the convention. And
right.
Yeah. And everybody's cheering her up and so...
Yeah.
Yeah. The massive scale is what impresses me. It's so huge, those conventions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The spectacle.
Yeah.
And so do people, I mean, does there seem like there's a general preference to one candidate or the other?
Yeah. I think people here really didn't, like, sort of loathe George Bush.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think there's much information as to what Kerry has that's so different from George Bush.
Yeah.
And just the other day, that his comments on, like, war and terror.
Yes.
Like, you can't win that or whatever.
Yes.
That was taking up pretty big because the self-defense troop was sent in March from here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it depends on the outcome of the American election whether or not they're going to stay there.
Right.
So, yeah. But it's the difference between Kerry and Bush isn't so clear. It's just people really don't like Bush.
Yeah, well, I can understand that. So, and when you say it depends on the outcome of the elections here, by Angela, that it depends on the outcome of the elections here whether the Japanese troops stay or not. Will they leave if George Bush stays in office, or...
They won't leave if he stays in office.
But they'll leave if Kerry comes in?
Well, if Kerry comes in, then the whole cabinet of the Japanese government would have to deal with that
In
a very serious way. Because the cabinet members right now just are like puppets of George Bush or American government.
Uh-huh.
So they just do whatever America says. So if Kerry gets in, I think they just have to readjust their attitude and, you know, relationship in a huge, huge way. And just the decision to send the self-defense troop in the first place was made in such a way that it did not reflect anything that we decided or we thought or we wanted. So if Kerry comes in, I think the Japanese cabinet either has to, like, listen to what people would say now.
Uh-huh.
I think...
Yeah. I'm sorry, finish your thought. No, I want to hear the rest of it. I was just going
to... So there's that, the self-defense troop issue, right, in Iraq. But then there's this whole thing about Charles Jenkins. Do you know him?
Oh.
Charles Jenkins, who was in Korea, the Korean War,
uh-huh.
And deserted his troop to, like, escape to North Korea.
Uh-huh.
And there he was married to a Japanese woman who was kidnapped from here. North Koreans, like, send their spies and kidnap Japanese. So he was married to a Japanese woman in North Korea, and they had children and everything for, in the last 20 years. And then last year, the Japanese government pressed on North Korea so that... Last year. So she actually came back to Japan.
Uh-huh.
And then this, like, just a month ago or so, they got reunited in Indonesia. North Korea let go of Charles Jenkins and two of their children to Indonesia, and then they came to Japan via Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, this whole, like, I don't know, the fiasco about what's going to happen to him. And, of course, you know, he faces very, very serious charges in terms of the American military law.
Right.
But the way the media is talking about him here is that he's somehow, like, part of this kidnapped, you know, poor little Japanese woman who got kidnapped and had to live in this horrible situation for the last 20 years. So the sentiments... of the popular mass is going towards her for her to have a better life here.
Right.
And that means Jenkins staying here.
Right.
And not be executed.
Right. Executed?
Yeah, there is a whole talk about it because he deserted his truth, but also, like, he worked for North Korean government. Those, you know, charges are, like, so serious that he might, he's, like, 70-something years old.
Right.
And he still might get executed or something.
Right. Well, basically, basically whatever they do, well, he would die.
Yeah.
In prison or, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, so he came here about 2 weeks ago. He had some medical conditions, and then the military, the U.S. base sent their officials to see him and convinced him that they won't charge him as seriously as they would. But, you know, he still has to collaborate with the military and, like, give all the information that he has about North Korea or whatever. And what was so interesting to me about this whole fiasco was that, so the Japanese media portrays him as this, like, you know, guy who that we should be sympathetic towards, too. And then there's several, like, American commentators on Japanese TVs, where they just speak very fluent Japanese and comment from the American perspective.
Right.
And they would just say, you know, you guys call him Jenkins-san. But you should not put son at the end of his name. Because he's a criminal. And the reaction to that in this, like, news TV or news shows or, what is it called, like, tablet shows, they're just like, huh? He's a criminal? What? So there's, like, a big gap in, like, understanding the U.S. military law.
Right.
And then his private life in North Korea as part of this Japanese, you know, family or whatever. So.
Well, that sounds interesting. I haven't heard anything about that.
Yeah.
But I also haven't heard much of anything. Like,
did you hear about Bobby Fischer?
No, tell me about Bobby Fischer.
Well, you know the Bobby Fischer, the chess master? He disappeared. For a while. Well, he got caught in Japan.
Well, caught?
He was detained by the Japanese my immigration officer. Because I guess he had invalid U.S. passport. And there's been rumors, you know, that he lives here once in a while, or he lives between here and Philippines, but nobody could really catch him. And finally they got him, and this was happening at the same time this whole Jenkins story was holding out. So Bobby Fischer got detained. And if he said back to America, then he faces serious charges there.
You know, I don't even know why he would face serious charges.
The Cold War thing. He went to play chess in, I can't remember which country it was, in one of those Eastern European country that was not, it was a communist country. I can't remember which country it was. To play this chess game. And he won the money. And there was an embargo because of the Cold War with the country. So he was told even before the matches that if he goes and wins the money, then that's violating the law, the U.S. law. But he went and played the game anyway. And he got the money and he went away. And now, like, you know, I think maybe 20 years he's been, like, underground. He's just, nobody knows where he's at.
Just spending the money.
Yeah, and he's, like, he has all these conspiracy theories. About how the U.S. government had, like, broken into his stores in L.A. Took out all the papers and, like, all this crazy stuff. So anyway, to make a long story, is this even interesting?
It is. I feel like I feel silly that I don't know any of this stuff.
No.
But I guess
Bobby Fischer's
the point of why I'm calling you.
You can let me know if it's really boring.
No. I mean, I love, like, well, I mean, I kind of live in a self-created bubble here, but it's interesting, like, what is the media frenzy in Japan as opposed to here, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, the Bobby Fischer's was happening here at the same time that Jenkins was happening.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of people said that, they speculated that the Japanese government is going to send back Bobby Fischer, and in, you know, by, like, in, what is it, bargain with that, and ask the U.S. government to be nice to Charles Jenkins.
Right. Now,
and it seems that's what happened.
And so, now, are you telling me these things because these things relate directly to the United States? I mean, are there other sorts of tabloid frenzies happening, or are these the ones you're telling me because I'm just curious, like, you know?
Oh, I'm telling you this because I think it's somehow related to America.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
There's so many other tabloid stories that I can tell.
Well, why don't you just tell me one, you know, that, like, I definitely would not have heard of. There's a very specific Japanese
tabloid?
Yeah, or, you know, juicy whatever media frenzy that...
The Olympics, you know, the Olympics was happening last week. So, this hammer thrower from Hungary got the gold.
In
Athens, in the hammer throw.
Oh, hammer throw, okay.
Yeah. And the Japanese Olympic Committee, they're usually very quiet and very unconfrontational.
But
the second guy, the guy who got the silver, was the Japanese guy, and, you know, he was supposed to get the gold, as is everybody else was. So the Japanese Olympic Committee, like, got really courageous and asked the Olympic Committee to, like, have this Hungarian athlete go under the doping test. After he won the gold medal. And, of course, the Hungarians, like, refusing to do that, and whatever, and then the Olympic Committee decided to take away his gold medal.
Because and, he refused.
Right, right. So then, like, the tabloid is that, you know, finally the Japanese Olympic Committee raised their voice, and look what happened, we can do what we want.
Okay. So did he end up getting the gold then? Did Japan end up...
Yeah, he got the gold.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I guess, there are many cases where the gold medal was taken away in the past, and a lot of people actually don't return the gold, so the Olympic Committee actually has to give out 2 golds.
Oh.
Yeah. So on the record, there's only 1 gold medalist, but the thing itself, there's 2 gold medals.
But there's a Hungarian with a gold medal somewhere that, quote-unquote, doesn't deserve it, or... Right.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, he probably shows up on eBay sometimes.
A Hungarian hammer thrower. exactly, on eBay. Or at least a claim that that's what it is.
Yeah.
Well, Maki, well, it's fun talking to you.
Oh, my goodness.
It is a horn. We have fantasies that we're coming to visit you someday. What's your plan? Are you guys there for, like, are you there indefinitely now, or?
No, I'm looking for a job, so wherever the job takes me to, I'll probably move. But until next June, you're here. For sure, so come and visit.
Yeah, okay. I just can't even imagine traveling with a little kid all the way to Japan and then putting that upon you. So where are you applying to jobs? What kinds of jobs are you applying for?
Teaching jobs, academic jobs.
Teaching art history?
Yeah, art history or visual culture.
Uh-huh.
Or history. But the job market is really grim. Both in America and here. So, we'll see. I might start a commune. I think that's a really great idea for now.
Uh-huh. Sounds good. Where I was talking to someone else who actually lives in sort of that kind of situation. Well, two people, actually.
Yeah?
Someone who lives on a kibbutz and then someone who lives in a group squat in Spain.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah.
Do they like it?
Yeah. Well, the woman that I spoke to on the kibbutz, she helped found the kibbutz, you know, I don't know how many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
She's been in Israel almost 50 years, so
mm-hmm.
something like 40 years or something.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Yeah. And we went to visit her there once, actually, and it was amazing. It was like,
really?
Yeah. It was lovely.
Oh, you have to tell me about it
Okay, well now I have about 3 more hours. I bought a phone card so I could call you.
Oh.
So we've got about 3 more hours of conversations we can have together.
That sounds great.
But I should probably go because I have a couple of artists I'm going to interview today and a couple more people I need to check in with.
Yeah, please do it. I hope I didn't bore you.
Not at all.
I don't even know if that was cohesive. I was, like, skipping over in my head.
It's beautiful.
And but, you know, all the information is on the internet.
Yeah, exactly. check my sources. So thanks so much for staying awake late 2 nights in a row. I'm sorry.
No problem. And thanks for calling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will try you again at a more humane hour.
Okay.
All right. Say hi to James.
Okay. Take care.
Okay. You too. Bye bye.
Bye.
That was Maki in Japan, giving his an outsider's perspective in. So now we'll check in with Wade Nasanovich, Brooklyn-based writer, who has been giving us his daily commute into his day job at FIT in 27th Street.
Hey, have you always called me on this number?
Well, yeah, haven't I?
I thought it was like a 718 number. This one actually came out. Oh, no, you know what? It hasn't been. I don't know. I can't remember 678
my screen.
Myself,
you mean me calling the number that I'm calling from?
Yeah, it's weird. I guess I programmed into my phone as Radio Free Erica.
Uh-huh.
And then but for some reason, I've always been looking at it as a 718 number, but I think I'm wrong.
No, you're right, because today I'm at the gallery, so I'm calling from my cell.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. So
how do you do that? You're broadcasting?
Yeah, I'm broadcasting from the gallery through their dial-up.
How do you... whatever. I guess it's very technical. You couldn't explain it to me.
Oh, yes, it's very technical.
Is it? Or are you just mocking me?
Both. But it's like it's my laptop and an internet connection and some microphones and an amplifier like thing between the laptop and the microphones, and then the telephone gets hooked into the amplifier also. So it's basically the same setup here as it is at home, except at home I have wireless and I can use my regular telephone.
Uh-huh. And you can just plug it right in?
Yeah.
Plug everything in.
The same way.
It's just plugging everything in, that's the key.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine. I'm actually on the FIT campus today.
Uh-huh.
And I have this funny little news that, I guess, you know, like I said, the building I work in, it's like the kind of police command center,
mm-hmm.
or one of a police command center. And I guess these guys, these cops, were walking around all over FIT, just kind of like looking in the classrooms and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And then some commander put up a big sign saying that that all of the cops are to remain in the police command center and not go to any other areas of the FIT campus.
Uh-huh.
But they were just totally wandering around and checking out all the young women on campus, because it is mostly women who go to FIT.
Fashionable women, too.
Whatever. I guess a certain kind of fashion. I don't think they're very imaginative. But I guess they're fashionable. They're fashionable. I don't know what kind of fashionable you would call them. They're kind of conventionally fashionable.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part. I mean, when I was growing up in, not really growing up in New Jersey, but, you know, my later teens in New Jersey, I was sort of FIT as being, like, filled with, like, crazy dressing people.
Uh-huh.
But then working here completely belied that notion.
Uh-huh.
So,
No, you're the crazy.
Hey, do you want to speak to Anthony DePaolo? Do you know Anthony DePaolo, the artist who was in the Buzzer 30 exhibition?
I do, yeah. I mean...
Do you want to be on the radio?
No.
He doesn't want to be on the radio.
So,
I don't listen to... I mean, just you can just say hi to the Radio Free Erica listening audience. He doesn't want to be... He's very fashionable, Anthony is.
Uh-huh.
He dresses very well. You're just very nice today. Jeez. Are you doing some kind of... Oh, really? No, but you're fashionable.
He's also a recent father, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a recent father. You want to tell him... Well, what if he talks to him about fatherhood? That would be good. He needs a topic. I'm talking to Erica DeVries. Do you guys know each other? I never know how everyone connects. But, yeah, it's Erica DeVries, and she started Radio Free Erica. It's internet radio, and she's doing it as a part of, I'm sorry, what's the exhibition called again?
Watch What We Say.
Watch What We Say, don't tell me, oh my God, I can't, my memory just sucks. Why can't I remember the name of the, give me the first letter of the gallery.
X.
X? X?
It's Schroeder Romero Gallery.
Why did you say X?
Just to stump you.
Oh, man, you're really... There's a kind of a theme of mocking you. Are you ready to lunch or something like that? All right, he's going to get some coffee. All right, so...
It's all right. There's all right. No need to force them.
Check out the Jumbotron. That's another thing I was going to report on, the Jumbotron.
What's the Jumbotron?
There are these giant Jumbotrons that they park, the portable Jumbotrons, like... I don't know exactly what they... I think there's those huge screens.
Oh.
But then they also have... And I think it's a part of... Did you hear about when they tested out those speakers that... they used them in Iraq to... And I'm not sure if they've done this in Iraq or not. To broadcast really, really high-pitched, piercing, painful... Or painful sounds.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it very, very uncomfortable for people who are nearby.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they can use the same technology to broadcast, you know, messages in public,
mm-hmm.
where it's particularly noisy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what these things are, because I think they're part screens, but then there's another part of them that has these giant speakers. I don't really know. I guess I could go up to one of these guys and ask them. But I'm so afraid to go up and ask anyone anything. There's so many police around that I'm afraid they'll just shoo me away, and I couldn't take that. So that's another thing. But I don't know, but they're amazing. They're huge. And what they can do is they can kind of like, I think they have like hydraulics and stuff, and then they can raise them up and down.
Well, wasn't there some talk that they were going, that it was a possibility of crowd control during the protests? Like, that sort of sound?
Uh-huh. If it got out of hand, they could just, like, flip the switch and everyone would, like, cower to their knees.
Yeah, so maybe that's what you're seeing.
I don't know. I mean, I was thinking maybe there's some kind of protest planned up 8th Avenue or something. And we're preparing for that. But, yeah, I really don't know. And there's some kind of stage set up on 30th Street. I can't see what it says. I think it says, good job.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know who that is who's staging that.
Are you reading the newspaper at all or anything?
I'm reading very, very little about the convention.
Me too. I mean, just on the subway, I'm reading.
I just think it's like such a non-event. I mean, both conventions to me are kind of non-events. I mean, I watch more of the Democratic National Convention
uh-huh.
On PBS.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it's like I was listening to Bill Frist last night, and I just had to, like, turn it off.
Right.
It's just because, you know, it's just kind of what you expect, and I don't know. They're both, I mean, I just think they're both non-events. People pretty much forget about them, and who knows, it's probably, election probably will be determined by some completely unrelated event that sways public opinion or something that happens, like, within closer proximity to election day,
right.
You know. So, you know, right now it seems like the whole, that Swift Boat ad is really, it's like,
right.
It's being, it's kind of influential. But, I mean, they have a good lineup. So, I don't know, it's, in Schwarzenegger, he's worthless. But he's very good for them, I think, so.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like there's a lot of sort of star power being waved around.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I heard this thing that Del Miller is speaking, and he spoke at one of the Clinton conventions.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I guess he spoke at the 92 convention. Hmm. So that's interesting. I don't know anything more about that, though. I heard that on NPR. So, the only other thing I have to report, convention related, you know, I feel like I've been kind of caught between, the topic of my commute in the Republican National Convention.
Uh-huh.
And I've fulfilled neither, in terms of reportage. But, this is my final tidbit of information, and I'm reading off a sign right now. The American Apparel and Footwear Association and Fashion Institute of Technology, honors Republican congressional spouses. Today at the Marvin Feldman Center.
Oh, wow.
So there's some happening things going on at FIT. Related to the convention. What was that?
For the spouses.
For the spouses. You know, because really, the spouses, they have to do something. They have to occupy them with something.
Yeah.
You know?
Certainly. Keep them off the streets.
I mean, what are you going to do with your congressional accessory that you're married to? But I can't say that. It's horrible to say that. I'm assuming they're all like accessories. They're not accessories. Willow Bush. She's really into reading.
Right.
And other stuff. So,
I
don't know what the hell she's reading. I want to know what she's reading.
I'm sure you do. I want to know too.
I'm sure she's not like digging deep into the Thief Journal, you know. I'm sure she's not really into like spittle on penis imagery. Oh, sure. Let me read this passage to you.
I do think though that would make a really beautiful, like, article, somehow, like, her reading list in comparison
someone could infiltrate the library and, like steal the stack of books on her nightstand.
Right.
You know, see what she's really reading, like, not some...
Or look up the information through the public library system and see what she's checked out lately.
Yeah, we were just using the recent laws, and we wanted that information. We have all right to that information. And they can't even tell Laura Bush that I requested it.
Yeah.
So, I wonder, you know, that'd be interesting, but she doesn't, I mean, maybe she takes books out of the Library of Congress.
Right.
And she, like, actually goes there because it's a great, like, PR thing. Oh, Laura Bush is at the Library of Congress again. But, like, she'd probably take books out on, I don't know. Some kind of like the flora of southern Texas or something.
Who knows?
You know, she's a complex individual like all of us, so we really don't know. She's a mystery.
Yes.
I think she's pretty good looking. You know, I think she has an appeal. She's young.
Yeah.
She reads. She's kind of like a foxy, bookish, like enlightened Texan.
Uh-huh. Enlightened.
Yeah. I think on social issues, I bet you she's like relatively more liberal than her husband.
I imagine, but I mean, how could the being married to George Bush and this idea of being enlightened be...
We never know, like, maybe she, at first she was attracted to him because he was a bad boy.
Right.
You know, and then that bad boy thing, like, faded fast, and then she gave him that ultimatum or whatever she did.
Right.
And then he stopped drinking, and then he became more of, like, a family man. Because I guess she did, like, some kind of, ultimatum or something, or intervention with him.
Oh, yeah?
I mean, the thing is, how could she not know he was, like, doing, like, coke and, you know, I mean... I don't know.
She was busy reading.
I mean, she has to, like... There's a whole dark side to all these people that no one ever knows about, and no one will ever... I mean, who really cares? I guess it doesn't matter. But I guess it just seems... I just want to know I would love to know, like, what these... Like, someone like George Bush, he obviously... skimmed off the top of, you know, all of his privilege... You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and just took advantage of everything, just kind of, like, parasitically. And snorting cocaine, I guess, is a part of that. I mean, I don't know. Is that proven that he used to snort cocaine? Michael Moore said it, so, hey, it must be true.
Exactly.
But.
Thanks for forwarding the article yesterday.
What?
The Arundhati Roy, thank you for forwarding that.
Oh, yeah. I didn't read it. I forward many articles that I just read the headline. I'm a big headline reader, which is really bad. I wish I could. I do. I've been reading, I read two articles on the new Art Spiegelman book.
Uh-huh.
I think it's called, like, something Under the Shadows of the Tower or something like that.
Hmm.
I read the New York Times one, and I read another one in The Guardian. That they were interesting. So I read those. But, you know, it's like, I don't know, I just feel, or maybe, I mean, occasionally I read an article on the Chechens, but, it's weird. In the very, very beginning of this, you know, the whole election season, during the primary season, I read a lot of articles, and I used to go to the Washington Post a lot and read stuff, and it's weird. I just don't have any kind of endurance for that kind of thing. I get so sick of it, so cynical, so fast. I just can't even read anything about it. So sometimes, like, you know, I read everything offline. I don't buy the newspaper anymore.
Right.
And I just go from paper to paper. And I used to read El País a lot. And I don't read that anymore, which I should, because I'd much rather read news from El País than the New York Times.
Right.
I don't know what's happening to me. Although I'm reading all these graphic comics now.
Yeah, that's what Amy said.
That seems to be right, like, at my level at this point.
Uh-huh.
You know, like a precocious... I'm like, my intellectual level is a precocious seventh grader. You know?
Uh-huh.
But yeah, I think they're really interesting. And I think they'd be good to give to kids. Although maybe they'd have nightmares. You can't, like, are you going to give, like, a kid who's, like... 13 or something, or 14, a comic that, like, it's about, like, massacres and genocide and...
Right. Well,
you know.
I don't know. I guess I don't know when they learn about that stuff.
Yeah, because, you know, I know that, I'm trying to think how old, a friend of mine whose, grandparents survived Auschwitz and his father was, kind of adopted by a Catholic family. I think it was in Warsaw, and actually it was amazing. The father survived, you know, with his family, and the grandparents both survived Auschwitz. And for a long time, they didn't tell him. And then I think I'm wondering what age, but I think that's about the age, like around 13 or 14 or something.
Right.
They told him all about that. And isn't there? I'm trying to think. What is that? There's a film. Because what was that, oh my god, I don't even know why I speak about these things, but I remember just fragments. But there was an exhibition I went to see, and then it had this clip from this film, and then the film was exactly about that. It was about, like, parents, and there was a scene from the film where these parents arguing about when they should tell their son.
About,
and it's strange because I know, and I work with two people who are, daughters of Holocaust survivors.
Uh-huh.
The one woman, her, actually it wasn't her, it was her father remarried after his whole family was killed. I'm not sure, you know, where they were killed, but they were killed, and he was in Brooklyn at the time. And then he remarried after that, and then that's when he had, and then also another, my other boss, she had parents, who both survived. So it's interesting. I know three people who have connections to this,
mm-hmm.
which is amazing. I guess part of it is, you know, being in New York, but I just find it, amazing. So, and you know, here's my boss walking by right now, probably wondering why the fuck I'm sitting out here with a cell phone wandering around in the sun. Maybe if I turn slightly, like one quarter to the left, she won't, she's looking uptown. Hi! totally snapped. I was looking at her, just looking uptown, and then she turned to the right and just looked right at me. So, I guess it doesn't matter. It's like Graham Greene and his FBI file, which he thought would be really thick, and then when they declassified all these documents, I guess he could look at these files.
Uh-huh.
So he had a friend who could get the files, and the friend got him the file, and it had like three sheets of paper in it. So all these years he had spent thinking he was being pursued by, you know, different government operatives, and you know, being all his activities being tracked, and then when it came down to it, it was like three sheets of paper. Rich, imagine how crushing that would be if you base like a lot of your kind of sense of purpose for all those years on the feeling that you were doing something that was important enough to be tracked by the government.
Yeah, but then don't you then just assume though that half of it or all of it's been shredded and you're only getting access to these three?
Yes, the perspective of a true paranoid. No, it's interesting, because can you say paranoid like as a noun? Like someone is like a neurotic. You can either be neurotic, you can be described as neurotic, or you are a neurotic. He is the famous neurotic, performer. And then, can you say he was a paranoid?
I've never heard it used in that way. But, I'm sure you can say it, but I don't think I've ever heard it used that way.
Graham Greene, the famous paranoid. It really doesn't sound very good. The famous paranoid writer sounds better. Anyway, yeah, maybe that's true. But no, but it wouldn't be shredded. It would come back with those black marks on it, the blackouts.
Right.
They black out all that stuff.
But if it was so bad, then they just shred it all because everything would have I don't know. Yeah. I agree with you, but I probably would wonder. Also.
You're are you a conspiracy theorist?
I think sometimes I want to be, and so therefore I am, I guess. I don't know. I mean, not
like,
really.
Would you believe, like, that's not really total conspiracy, but would you believe that George Bush or his administration ignored certain things thinking that an attack would happen, but they didn't think an attack would happen at such a grand scale, but they thought an attack would happen, and it would somehow support their militaristic aims more politically, so they kind of let things slide and hope that something would happen? Did you think that?
I would want to know more. Do you know what I mean?
I don't particularly, like, I wouldn't believe something like that.
Uh-huh.
But, like, I would hope that a human being would, that human beings would be better than that.
Yeah, no, I would hope they would be better than that, too, but I also don't have much faith in...
Yeah. I mean, the people who, like, believe it was, like, totally orchestrated somehow.
Right.
Yeah, I definitely don't believe that.
The
thing is, the way I'm talking about, I could talk about religion in the same way. Like, I would say, oh, parting the Red Sea, I definitely don't believe in that.
Right.
But same thing, parting the Red Sea, conspiracies, sort of the same thing, it's just faith. Because you're never going to know.
Right. Well, I mean, I think maybe part of, like, yeah, I guess part of me wants to believe in some sort of magic or something like that, too. So I guess that's what, like, leans you towards.
Like what kind of magic? Like spirits?
I don't know. Yeah, anything. Like anything. Like you just kind of want to believe, you know?
Guardian angels?
Nothing quite that cute. But, I mean, not
that. Well, how do you know a guardian angel isn't, like, is cute? Maybe a guardian angel is softing.
Right. Yeah.
And maybe they don't guard you, like, they'll let you get really drunk and put yourself in near danger. But, I always had this guardian angel picture. My mother always would say, talk about guardian angels protecting me. No, but sometimes, I want to be completely rational and say, no, there's nothing that exists like that. We're just, like, these, like, organisms determined by laws of biology, and we just function according to laws of biology. That's it. And we're very sophisticated, or what I guess depends what perspective you take, maybe not so sophisticated human beings, and there's nothing like that exists. But then sometimes, like, there are a lot of times, like something happens, and I totally avert disaster, like, I'm running a bike, and I feel like I almost just rode out in the middle of the street and, like, got run over by a cement truck or something. Or I was about to step out in the street and I was almost run over by a bus. Or, like, my father one time almost, like, stabbed me in the eye with, like, an awl and I averted disaster. Then I was like, well, maybe something was, you know, maybe I was protected, you know, at that point. So, maybe someone protected me. Here you go. Yeah, I'm helping here. Someone dropped some mail. There you go.
Wade?
You're welcome. Yeah.
I'm going to go. I have one of the artists coming in at 2 o'clock.
All right. Okay, so anyway, I'll try to do better next time, Erica.
Stop that right now. You've been great. I'm like, you know, today is the wrong day for me to, like, try and give a pep talk, but here it is. It's been absolutely fabulous having conversations with you. And I appreciate your reporting and your giving of your time, and I mean that all.
I'm reporting.
Yes. And because of your non-linearity is part of why you were sent into the field. So
this is kind of like, I feel like I'm in the room, there's some operative smoking, and they're telling me why I was chosen. I never realized it all these years, but finally I'm finding out why I was chosen. I'm like I'm Yuri. Well, there isn't the agent who was brought up in the United States to take down the Soviet agent who was brought up in the United States to take down the United States. Didn't they call him Yuri?
I don't know, Wade.
Okay. Anyway, I'm going to say hi to my wife who's out there listening. And
your baby.
Sweetie pie, thanks for making the salad for tonight. I really appreciate that. Okay, so have fun, Erica. Thanks again. And hold on, I'm talking to you just one more day, right?
You're talking, you know, actually Zenya and her partner Misha are doing the broadcast in Russian tomorrow. So I'll talk to her tonight and see if she still wants to do an English segment or not. I think they were thinking that most of it would be in Russian. So
okay.
All right. But I'll let you know. But I
okay.
As far
all
as
right, great. All right, see you, Erica.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye, Wade. Thank you.
Oh, sure. You're welcome. Thanks.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So that is Wade Nasanovich, and Carrie Moyer is not here yet, so we'll give Mary Adams a call at her dress shop on Lori's side. It's a hot day in the gallery. It is. The other day there was a good breeze.
Are you just wearing this in your dialect?
Yeah. Pardon me? It's fine. I'm running it through the dial-up, and I'm even from home through the wireless, through the DSL, I do it on the slowest because then people with dial-up can listen. I heard that you get wireless on the roof here.
Yeah, and it keeps getting further away. I have to go further and further.
Oh, no.
You should go further there.
I have to go further, like, more building things in the house.
I have to walk further over now.
Because,
oh, on the roof.
Because the people that used to be next to us are gone now. So it's like all the way up in the house.
So I'm waiting here. My phone is, for some reason, it goes flip-flops between barely any connection to a lot of connection. And right now, it's trying to grab a line. Are you guys able to get a, through your phone line here?
Well, yeah, we can do that.
But you can't get DSL through the phone? Sitting here with Carler Peace, Paco Rodriguez, and Seth, whose last name I don't know.
Wachtel.
Carly, you want to tell us about your performance today? I mean, otherwise, then I have to resort to reading to everyone in my dreary... All right, hold on. First, you have to put on a microphone.
Okay.
All right.
Am I on? Should I put it higher?
You put it higher.
Should I just hold it?
Let's see which one you're connected to here.
Hello.
All right. So, Carrie Moyer was supposed to come in at 2 o'clock. I have a feeling, since I didn't confirm with her, that maybe she forgot, but maybe she'll come in a couple minutes.
Okay.
Looking blustery.
Yeah. Is it 2 already?
It is 2, yeah, a little after.
Wow. Hello, Erica.
All right, so this is Carla, who I talked to her about her work the first day we broadcasted, and the levels were kind of crummy. But can you again describe your piece that's actually here in the gallery and then what you did today?
Okay. So the piece in the gallery, it's titled Bodies on Support, and it's an old wagon wheels that I got off of eBay, and... wheels that are meant to be drawn by a horse, so like part of an old horse-drawn carriage. And I've kind of restructured them into like a rickshaw meant to be pulled by a human. And on the wagon is a neatly folded stack of fabrics in a very nice pile from all over the world. And they're all borrowed fabrics. And
I didn't realize that they're all borrowed.
Everything's borrowed.
Uh-huh.
And I think I was just thinking about, I was thinking about, like, the early pioneers in the Westward Movement and labor and people that carry the load or carry the burden and also movement and exchange in addition to that, like exchange of materials or of resources.
And so what about the materials that you used? I mean, they're specific for the one in here.
Yeah.
And for both, actually.
Yeah, and for the one today.
Yeah.
That I did. The ones in here, my mom gave me a lot of fabrics. My mom comes from southern Italy, and she migrated here after World War II, and my dad migrated here in the 60s, and both my parents worked in the garment industry as tailors. So, and my family has lineage with fabrics, and so a lot of the fabrics on the cart were made by my great-grandmother and my grandmother or my great-aunts, and they're embroidered or hand-sewn.
Oh, wow.
And some of the pieces my mom made as well.
Uh-huh.
So there's a connection there, like a personal connection for me, historically. but I think it also can mean many other things. It means many other things for me. And today's piece, I was in Union Square from 10 to noon, and I filled up a shopping cart with my clothing and was giving them away. And I got really interesting responses.
And so how did you choose...
It's completely weird talking into this little baby
microphone. It's because you aren't wearing enough clothes to wear the microphone.
I never wear enough clothes. CarlaRapice@yahoo.com.
Broadcasting in the bus.
As we were saying, it's very hot in this gallery.
The little microphone makes a good nipple clamp also. So how did you choose the clothes today? Like what you were going to give away?
I was trying to just be like, what's necessary? And the few of the pieces I really adored in it was like when I was loading up the cart last night, I was like, oh, can I really part with this? I don't know if I can. And then I'm just thinking about what do I regard as important and feeling like what is really necessary and it being okay to kind of let go of certain things. Like if I were to pick up and move tomorrow, like with just a suitcase or, you know, a cart full of stuff, what would those necessities be?
Uh-huh.
Of course, it's not my intention to kind of load other people up with unnecessary objects in their life, you know. And a lot of people were quite honest, you know, they were interested and they were asking what's going on here. And, you know, I got quite a few responses of, you know what, I don't need anything either. I have a closet full of stuff. I live in this teeny New York apartment.
Yeah.
I don't have to purge myself. But, and then we were, a group of us were talking about Wednesdays being giveaway days in Union Square.
Right.
Starting off like a weekly thing.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I mean, that's kind of a phenomenon right now, isn't it? Like, people have parties, like exchange your stuff parties.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of, but,
yeah, like, I don't need this or want this, or is someone else going to want this? But, of course, I mean, there's one thing where it's like someone's junk is someone else's treasure, but it's also, like, really nice to kind of just exchange something. Like,
yeah.
Like, the act is kind of fun.
This is Paco Rodriguez, also an artist.
I was just going to say, I recently got onto Freecycle.com, which is a Yahoo group. And it's regional, so you can log on to your area, and this whole culture of giving stuff away.
Oh, that's very cool.
It's incredible because, I mean, what it does is it really puts stuff like it really recirculates stuff, and it has to be free, and whoever wants it has to come and, you know, pick it up.
Right, in a reasonable amount of time.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
And then there's also kind of a protocol. For instance, they advise you to kind of screen people. You know, maybe wait a few days when you advertise something to be given away. And because, you know, some places are, you know, like some institutions can, you know, get things, and they perhaps, people feel, are more worthy of, like, certain things that are being given away, so. But you get really into it.
Uh-huh. And so what kinds of things are people giving away?
Anything.
Really?
Absolutely anything.
Uh-huh.
You name it, it's listed. So books, like, by title, or books by law. Fans, TVs,
huh?
Cell phones, huh? Furniture, and people post pictures,
uh-huh.
And cat trees. That's a big item.
Wow, that sounds like kind of like a... Well, I immediately thought, like, oh, is people trying to get rid of, like, really heavy shit that, like,
yeah.
They, like, you can't put in the mail or...
Yeah. But you'd be surprised. I mean, most people are really straightforward. They're really honest about what they're giving away, and a lot of times they have photographs. They post photographs as well. And some of the people I know who got turned on to this recently are, there is always a response.
Right.
And in most cases, you know, they come and do it. You know, they come and get it.
So here's the teacher lady in me. And I guess because I know you so well, Carl, I feel like I can say something like this. Like if I was talking to one of the artists I don't know. But like it seems like an exciting way then to bring your project, like something like that, to bring it, like to talk about this old world, like the fabrics. Not that you would give away the fabrics on your cart in this new world way, but like somehow to bring those two things together seems really exciting. Like,
yeah, because the cart here feels like preservation.
Right.
And then the cart in Union Square this morning felt like not consumption, but the opposite of what preservation would be. But also like a giving away. Whereas, you know, I think, okay, during war times, what do I want to preserve? Like, what are the ingredients that make me who I am?
Right.
Like, what do I really need?
Right. Right.
To keep.
Right.
Well, I don't know. It's like, you know, like my parents came with one suitcase and my dad came at $3.50. And I'm like, that just blows my mind.
It's unbelievable, yeah.
I just have boxes and boxes and boxes.
Exactly. And even after giving away a cart full of stuff today, no, I'm not trying to, like, make, like, a critical commentary, but just, like, it's like a heightened awareness of, like, wow, how many carts could I really fill up for,
yeah,
you know, to get to your one cart that you're going to take with you.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy, and how you say New Yorkers wouldn't take stuff because we're all so keenly aware of our space and the stuff issue.
I mean, so many people didn't even believe it. Like,
yeah,
it was like such the New York thing, like just moving really, really fast, you know, going to yoga, going to work, and they're like, free, no way. I don't believe it. And then some people would walk over and they were, really? No, really, what do I owe you?
Right.
Like, nothing. Giving this stuff away.
Without a pamphlet with some sort of, like, profit on it, you know, that you want them to read about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the cart that you were traveling around with today, I just wanted to describe it because it's very different.
Than the cart in the
space. Yeah.
The cart, yeah, because the cart in the space looks like a rickshaw and it's got wheels that are 125 years old. These shopping carts today, they're just like the kinds you pick up on in Chinatown, the kind of cart that you would take to your grocery store or the food co-op and fill up your groceries and wheel them back to our city apartments.
Right.
And the kinds that, you know, grannies use.
Yeah, or people, you see them, like, with laundry. Like,
yeah,
that's, like, people hauling, like, some gobs of laundry.
Yeah.
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 Hi, Carrie.
I don't
care. Hi, I'm Erica. Well, come on in. We're glad to see you. This is Carla Rapi. She's also an artist in the show, and this is Paco Rodriguez. Grab the mic, and thanks, Carla, for talking. Carla just did a... Will you hand her one of those chairs, please? Thanks. Carla just did a performance this morning in Union Square, so I was asking her about how that went. So I'm supposed to call Ricardo at 2:30. So just, and the last time I was late and he couldn't answer the phone. And
okay.
So I'm just, we've got like 20 minutes.
Okay. Should I wear this?
Yeah, I think, yeah. She was holding it because she didn't have enough clothes on really to get it close to her mouth. Perfect.
Is that good?
Yeah. And it's good to meet you.
Nice.
Yeah. the first person I'm gotten to speak to in person whom I haven't previously met.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, thanks for coming.
Yes, I haven't been able to look at the show. I mean, I've been away, so this is the first time I'm sort of encountering the whole show.
Oh, great. So good. Double reason to come.
Exactly.
Can you describe the piece because the few people that are actually listening, most people aren't in New York or can't come to the show, so...
The piece is called Psychogeographic Landscape, and basically it's about a 7x8 foot painting, which is acrylic and glitter. A lot of my work is sort of this marriage of like high modernist painting issues with resistance graphics, historical resistance graphics. So I use a lot of May 68 imagery and Iconography from the gay rights movement, the Black Power movement, sort of historical stuff from the 70s and even earlier, actually.
And is it mostly imagery that's been generated in the United States, or is it also outside that
it
you're referencing?
Comes from many sources. I'm sort of looking at the history of ephemeral resistance graphics and like what happens on the street. So the May 68 stuff that I use comes from Paris.
Mm-hmm.
I also have used a lot of constructivist posters mm-hmm. as just sort of jumping off points
mm-hmm.
for us to think about our relationship to both ephemera and the kind of graphic language that doesn't normally get show up in painting, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This one definitely references constructivist imagery.
Yes, I mean, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess I was asking people to talk a little bit, like, how did you bring, like, painting, bring those two things together? How did your art making and your political making, when did they start intersecting? Or
that's a great question. I've been involved with politics since like the late 80s, I guess. I started working with ACT UP and did stuff with Queer Nation and a lot of gay civil rights activism in New York. So I did a lot of stuff with the Lesbian Avengers. So I'm like really involved in terms of making agitprop for groups because I earned money as a graphic designer, and I also painted. So I wanted to make some place where all this stuff could kind of intersect, essentially. And it just continues to be interesting to me, and I keep trying to invent new ways for these two languages to sort of hook up, essentially.
So you're half of Dyke Action Machine also,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Which I love your project.
Thank you.
And so can you talk about like the two different like that you guys work kind of in a very different way
yes.
than your painting?
Yes. Basically, I guess this past year I've been giving a lot of talks on my work, and I've sort of broken it into like three modes of production in some weird
mm-hmm.
way, because I do design work for commercial clients, then Dyke Action Machine somewhere sits between painting and like commercial work,
because mm-hmm.
it always shows up in public space, although it has been curated into gallery shows.
Mm-hmm.
We want it to be seen on the street. So.
Is there a problem?
Mark calls it the levels on carrier low.
Okay, thanks. I'll double check.
Bump yourself up a little too.
Okay, great. Thanks.
No, that's good.
Our sound guy. All right, great. So
basically, Dyke Action Machine was came out of us doing activism, but both Sue Schaffner, who's the person I work with, and I had been in, you know, the commercial design world, and we were like, God, we want to use all this stuff to say something that would both seamlessly fit into the street and also sort of undermine mainstream visual culture on the street.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the goal, and we've been doing it since 91, so we're still working together.
And do you feel any of those splits in your working process that you were saying you were feeling earlier, like before you started bringing it to your painting? Like, do you feel it between like your different projects that you're doing? Any?
I think I worked really hard to reconcile this.
Mm-hmm.
I think I figured out a way to acknowledge like the location of different kinds of work,
mm-hmm.
whereas Dam is very sort of glitzy and, you know, it looks like advertising. It's meant to look like advertising. And I understand how that functions on the street. and then like what kinds of visual languages operate in a gallery setting where people are used to looking at a different kind of image. So I think it's something that continues to interest me. I'm doing a whole new suite of posters that are not Dyke Action Machine. I'm sort of inventing graphics that will go with my painting. So it will be this other way of feeding into that.
Oh, interesting.
And they'll be, I've had two shows now with them where I've just given the posters away. So I always like to have something cheap when I show in a gallery because most people can't afford painting.
Uh-huh.
But
Is that our sound guy?
We still need to bump the door.
Okay, we're
all the way up, so maybe it just needs to get moved closer. Yeah. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
How's that?
That's great. I mean, even to me, it sounds a lot
better.
To me, it sounds better even.
Oh, start talking.
This is a test, right?
So, well, from the outside looking in, like it seems like it would be satisfying in many ways, like to be operating in all of these different venues, because I know sometimes maybe artists will complain about being like stuck in the gallery and that isn't who they want to be communicating these ideas to, or, you know, looking from the outside into the gallery. And so now it seems like you're traversing like all those worlds and kind of ripping into each other.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. It's really, it's funny because for a long time I was much more visible with Dam than I was with my painting, and the things seem to seesaw off each other. Mm-hmm. It's like if political stuff is quiet, then you might spend more time in the studio. So there's always sort of a location to say something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It works out. Mm-hmm. It's a good model, I think.
And okay, so then to shift again, I just was thinking about the glitter on your painting.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about the glitter?
Yes, this is the question I always get asked. I grew up with kind of bohemian parents, so I've been around kind of left politics my entire life, and I wanted to sort of re-enchant political iconography in this kind of childish, not childish, but childlike way.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm going to make it magic again.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, glitter seemed obvious. Then there's also the whole like association with, you know, glitzy like 70s gay liberation,
yes,
like Sylvester and stuff like that.
Right.
So it works on multiple levels,
right,
I think.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of, I guess, because my friend who uses a lot of glitter in his work is working off of those references. Also.
Right,
the,
right.
More than the childlike, but then, yeah.
Well, also that I often, because I gather a lot of my imagery off the web to later use in my paintings, and this stuff was kind of meant to look, you know, anti-aesthetic, I would say that in quotes. You know, like,
mm-hmm,
it's supposed to look down and dirty, like somebody just drew it quickly in the basement and have this...
the things you're referencing.
Yeah, this sort of, like, quick immediacy throwaway. So kind of giving them this sort of optical material value, although of course now I think they're beautiful, you know, in retrospect, but I don't think they were intended that way often. Like I gather lots of drawings and stuff from like revolution books, and the stuff is sort of so crudely drawn as if graphic language needs to be really basic to appeal to people who aren't schooled in it,
right,
which I don't really believe is true,
right,
but it seems to be embedded in some earlier stuff.
Right. I think that is interesting, because if you think about people that aren't really schooled in it, I think, you know, then they're most taken by, like, hyper-realism.
Right, you know? Right. But also, I think if it's really compellingly designed, you can get almost anyone.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's just, like, they can't articulate why they like
it. Yeah, absolutely. But. Yeah. So, I just had, of course, a question that I was so excited to ask you, and then it immediately popped right out of my head. But can you talk a little bit about the paintings? I mean, they are very formal, so can you talk about that aspect of them a little bit?
I am interested in speaking in this zone of, I mean, I also want to include the politics of painting in my discussion that I hopefully am carrying out in the paintings. You know, it's like a lot of the stuff I reference is this kind of utopian high modernism where a pour would just meld into the canvas and that would be it. It was about this ultimate objecthood of these two things synthesizing. And I think all of the emotional resonances around that stuff are all the sort of, what's the right word, both visual and experiential get cut out in that argument. So I'm sort of trying to, I'm using gestures that might be familiar in other locations and imbuing them with different meanings, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that it was this utopian way of thinking that kind of dead-ended, and I'm very interested in those things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that we have these aspirations, and often they're airtight, mm-hmm. so they can't succeed, because we don't allow them to have, like, failure embedded in it.
Well, and are you talking, because it's funny, because are you talking about, like, that those ideas in relation to painting and art, or are you talking about those ideas in relation to political movements?
Both.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, I'm sort of trying to draw an analogy because
right.
I've done not a huge, huge amount of organizing. I usually, my part in activism is often like this sort of minister of propaganda. So I'm like central, but I'm not really getting people out on the street except with posters. And I've noticed that because of our own sort of fallibility and how we are as humans, these things are really hot mm-hmm. for a little while and then they tend to dissolve. And that's just sort of the nature. It has this natural ebb and flow that I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how people, I don't know how one factors that in, but it's something that I'm thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the glitter goes to, you know, even though it doesn't necessarily always work out, things get accomplished and you can still just keep recreating this process and that it's necessary. It sounds very woo-woo, but I think you get what I mean.
Yeah, it does. Well, and it makes me think about, like, right now, like, in New York right now, like you're saying, things
right.
are really hot. Like, it's just, it seems very electric here right now. And my
right.
question, Keith, is like, well, how do we sustain even a fraction of, like, this electricity, this, like, desire for change that's happening right now? And maybe it's because I'm using the gallery as, I mean, I don't think it's because of that, but I mean, of course, it's very palpable here right
now.
So.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm, the thing that I have this sort of pit in my stomach about is that once the convention goes away,
mm-hmm.
I mean, this sort of, like, focusing element of having all these people trampling on our city,
right.
essentially, and having everything be made to accommodate their presence.
Right.
What's the next step, you know?
Right. Yeah, I guess I had held out hope that at least through the election there's going to be, like, some sustained
right.
something, but then, you know, either way, no matter who wins, like, the energy needs to be sustained.
Yes, absolutely.
And I don't, that's when I feel like the pit in my stomach.
Right.
that I can't explain.
And I think also that I haven't been alive during times when you watched. I mean, in my experience with activism, it's been around gay issues, and there has been change in the last 12 years or whatever. People's opinions have changed a lot. But it's like, it feels so difficult right now to change somebody's mind about something. Mm-hmm. It's like at this odd impasse. Mm-hmm. So then what happens?
Right. Well, it seems like the change maybe that we're asking for, or that I feel like I want to ask for, is that we all let go of a little bit of this privilege that we have. And like, who wants to do that? You know, like,
right.
That's a huge thing,
right,
to have to ask. You know, we need to check in with the rest of the world and look at what we have in comparison and let go. And that just seems like too big of a thing to ask at this point.
Right.
No, anyhow.
No, we're
anyhow.
Just completely depressed here.
Spiraling each other into your t-shirt. But I do want to say that your button, the Bush pun, your Run Bush Run, the lesbians are coming. That's my favorite Bush pun so far.
Oh, good. I'm so glad.
I actually, you know, and I keep bringing this up actually with different people that I'm talking to, but I'm not that excited about, like, the whole, like, lick Bush and fuck Bush, like, that whole genre of...
Yeah.
It kind of, and I feel like...
It's very,
It's kind of backhanded.
Lowest common denominator.
It looks like it's backhanded towards women, actually, and I don't know if I'm just not having a sense of humor enough about it, or...
I don't know. I'm of two minds about these things, because on the one hand, if you have something maybe a little bit more complicated or clever or something, people will never wear it.
Right.
So it's like, well, how do you get to... I absolutely agree with you. I don't feel like using that stuff is empowering in any way. Mm-hmm. I just feel like it's kind of stupid, actually. And I wouldn't ever wear something like that, I don't think. It just seems so...
Yeah, it makes me feel old. Maybe that's what it makes me feel like. Like, I just, yeah, interesting. I hadn't thought of it like that before. Like, maybe it's just a generational thing.
I think, like, during Pride, I saw lots of women wearing it at marches. And so then, in that context, it has this sort of even more, I mean, it's already a sexual, you know, statement, but it has a more sort of playful tone to it. But then once I started seeing them everywhere after that, and seeing them in shop windows and stuff, it's like, ugh. It's the whole, like, product tie-in to all this that kind of freaks me out, too.
Right.
But that's a whole nother talk show.
Thank you so much. I should probably call Ricardo before he completely writes me off.
You must get Ricardo Dominguez on your station. Yeah. Absolutely.
Tell me about your t-shirt.
This t-shirt is a student of mine, a painting student of mine made it for me.
It's really nice.
It has my name, for those of you in listening land, it has my name and then Dyke Action Machine Dam. In this sort of hypnotic
spiral
that you can completely get lost in.
Yeah, it's so really nice. Where do you teach?
I teach at Rutgers.
Oh, great.
So.
Oh, yeah, Janine Olson.
Yeah.
She speaks fondly of you, and I guess that maybe is where you go. She was a grad student there a few years ago.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
So.
The connections are starting to come
all
into
the
my
little
memory.
Right. It's the tiny planet of the art world.
Right. All right. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you, Erica. You rock. over all the trucks.
And enjoy the show. The art show. All right, so let's see. Let's see if my telephone can actually make a connection this time.
And thanks to Mark for calling in about the levels. You look very hot and sultry. There's a beautiful garden here at Schroeder Romero Gallery, roof garden. Cute, actually.
Hello?
Hi, Ricardo.
Hey, Erica.
Erica, it's Reese. We're on the radio.
Great.
Great. I'm so glad that we are connected.
Yeah. Even in this wide world of connectivity, sometimes it's quite difficult, though.
Yes. So how's it going? How's your,
online action?
Yeah, first
of all. Yeah, the virtual Senate right now is close to 300,000 people who have participated, starting on September the 29th. And these are what we call unique IPs or unique addresses.
Mm-hmm.
And the largest...
My call just faded. Darn it. I swear we are jinxed. Yes, I feel that we are jinxed. I really do.
Must be the electronic disturbance theater.
Yeah, oh my goodness. You know? So, okay, yeah. They're unique IPs is where I lost you.
Right. Well, the unique IP means an address and where it's coming from. And the largest percentage of those who have joined of the virtual sit-in, about 56%, come from the .coms here in the United States. Followed by .edu here in the United States, which is university-based.
Mm-hmm.
The largest non-U.S. participants have been from Spain, followed by Brazil, followed by Mexico, and then I believe U.K., France, and the furthest away or strangest is the Tonga Islands.
Wow.
And we had about 4 people from the Tonga Islands. Not that I know where that is.
I was going to say, I don't even know.
Probably somewhere in the Pacific.
Right.
The largest Asian community to participate was Australia, followed by Japan. And I don't remember the other countries, but it's a total of, I just looked at it this morning, something like 69 countries around the world participated, and I said it's around 300,000. So it's a pretty good number.
Yeah, that's outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you describe what the piece actually does? I've talked about it on different days, but can...
Sure. The Electronic Disturbance Theater has developed the theory and practice of electronic civil disobedience. Our frame by which we do and try to define electronic civil disobedience, although I certainly wouldn't impose that we're the only definition, is that first of all, we're transparent. We don't hide who we are. We always let people know our names, when we're going to do it, and also how we're going to do it. That is, our code is open source. And it's the most open source code possible. It's called HTML, which is the base of any browser technology. And basically, the virtual sit-in is 5 HTML pages that hit the reload refresh button on every public browser. taking into account how many people have entered to participate. And so once you enter the virtual sit-in, what happens is that it keeps hitting the reload refresh button over and over, and it hits the specific URL that you are doing the sit-in on. In this particular instance, it's the Republican National Convention site, the main site. So does that make sense to you? It keeps hitting refresh reload.
Yes.
And it only hits that button depending on how many people participate.
Oh.
So unlike a... Hello?
Yes.
So unlike a hacker that might use technically efficient means to bring down any site, and it usually takes one or two hackers to crack into servers, enslave them, and then send out massive packets, which are called distributed denial of service. And it doesn't matter how powerful your infrastructure is, Microsoft, Yahoo collapsed before these kind of deep hacker actions. But that takes a certain type of elite knowledge, and they always do it anonymously. It's what I call the digitally correct attitude of hackers. And we are a digitally incorrect group, the Electronic Disturbance Theater. That is, our software is made of the most basic open source code, HTML. Two, we're transparent. And three, the disturbance is only based on the amount of global community who participates during the time frame of the performance.
So you know the numbers of people that are participating. Is there any way to know what sort of effect it is having?
Well, you have to remember that contemporary sites like the one that the GOP are running are developed in infrastructure to receive millions upon millions of hits at one time.
Right.
So you have to ask yourself, does the disturbance of 300,000 people hitting the website all at the same time bring it down? I would say no.
Right.
But the main point of a sit-in, a virtual sit-in, like a real sit-in, is not to destroy the building,
mm-hmm.
is not to, stop anybody from actually moving slowly through the crowd to get where they're going, but it is to create the presence of a certain type of voice countering whatever that dominant media is being protested. So really the most important outcome of the performance is the amount of media that it gets. That makes sense?
Yes. I mean, it's the amount of media that it gets. I mean, meaning...
Newspaper stories about it.
Okay.
Online stories
okay.
about it. People discussing it. Because in the end, it is the disturbance is what I call semantics. It's about language.
Right.
And language being distributed. And the language that's being distributed is that there's a certain segment of the electronic population worldwide which had enough of the Bush regime.
Right.
And so that's the main core. And that's why we see ourselves as digitally incorrect in that we're not looking to be technologically efficient.
Mm-hmm.
That is, we don't want to use technology that actually works. Right? But we want to be symbolically effective.
Right.
The symbolic efficacy is really the main point of all this. And also, I mean, from the media, you often get journalists going, can we talk to the hackers or the crackers? And you go, no, because they're anonymous, they're secretive, and they're not going to talk to you.
Uh-huh.
So what is to happen in the society in the future wherein only these sorts of power bases like hackers and crackers are allowed to speak what public code is? And so we're trying to counter that sort of narrative and say that civil disobedience and its history here in the U.S. and around the world is and should be available to any individual who knows how to click.
Right.
And basically we say click equals action.
I like how you refer to it as performance as well. I haven't heard performance in relation to I've heard it in relation to digital media, but I mean not in relation to something like going to a site. So I like
right.
that. I like that as a concept and like the extension of both the surfing into the realm of performance and performance into the realm of surfing.
Yeah. I think it's an important gesture. Back in the late 80s, I was a member between 87 and 1995 of Critical Art Ensemble.
Mm-hmm.
And in that group in the late 80s, we developed the theory of electronic civil disobedience in two books that are available online, copy left in PDF form. All people have to Google or use Yahoo or any search engine that they prefer and write in Critical Art Ensemble. And the first book was called The Electronic Disturbance. The second book is called Electronic Civil Disobedience and Other Unpopular Ideas. So in a certain sense, the theory was there. But it wasn't until 1994, with the emergence of the Zapatista community in Chiapas, Mexico, that the network was developed in a way that the practice could be enunciated. And so one of the qualities that you were bringing out is, how is this performance, or how does it enact a certain kind of performativity, was that the theory that we had in the late 80s was that the networks were a performative matrix, and that it was a stage. And for me, I was trained as an actor and performance artist, so I always see everything as a performance.
Uh-huh.
And one of the elements that was still very difficult to define by the early 90s was, how would that performative matrix allow a global community to participate in it? And it wasn't until the Zapatistas emerged that that became very clear and coherent as to how the performative element of civil disobedience online would manifest itself. And they were very specific. That is, we had to be very poetic in the way that we established electronic civil disobedience. So one of the elements that the Zapatista FloodNet system, which does the virtual sit-in, not only hits the refresh and reload button, but we also use a traditional net gesture called 404 file, or files not found. And if you look up on, say, a website at, Bing.net, and you look up deadfish.html,
mm-hmm.
the Bing.net server will say deadfish is not found on this server.
Mm-hmm.
That's the 404 file.
Right.
What we do when we're doing a virtual sit-in, we upload questions on the back end, like, does justice.html exist on this server? And the server will respond in the background, justice does not exist on this server.
Right.
There's democracy. So we're uploading immaterial questions about a very real offline condition. The other element of the performance is that we navigate between transparency and simulation. That is, as I said before, we don't hide who we are, so we use transparency. At the same time, the virtual sit-in does create the kind of gesture that seems similar to what hackers do, but it is not hacking. It is a simulation of that way that hackers participate in culture, that is, by using code. So in a certain sense, if we were digital realists, we would use code that actually worked and brought the site down. But since we're magical realists, we create code that simulates the process of that sort of hacker gesture, but removes the technological efficiency from it. What's that?
That's interesting. That's interesting. I don't know enough to know that it would be possible to bring it down. And
mm-hmm.
and that's interesting. I mean, when you talk about the poetics, and it's beautiful and interesting to think about the choices between the two. You know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
The other thing that I'm often asked by different hacker communities or the military or universities or a myriad of different communities to, speak about the development of electronic civil disobedience, digital zapatismo, and the emergence of hacktivism from that. One of the things that I tell them is that at its core, this kind of performative matrix is based on the simple idea of Mayan technology. And they always go, what the hell is Mayan technology?
Right.
And so I always tell them this traditional Zapatista story. Todos a la consulta del 21, todos a la consulta del 21. Everybody to the consultation of the 21st, everybody to the consultation of the 21st. Beep, 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 beep. I, the big nose, was walking at the edge of a Toholaba village. Next to me was the deepest and wisest Zapatista, La Mar, the ocean. On the other side, Don Durito, the most famous invisible body in all of La Candona, who had written a very important book in 1968 at the Sorbonne, where he had been studying and had written a very important book called The Book of Mirrors, or The Defeat of Neoliberalism. Well, it so happens that we encountered Pedrito, a 2.5-year-old Toholabal, running around going, beep, 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 todos a la consulta del 21, everybody to the consultation of the 21st, when he bumped into the bottom of my boot. I looked down at Pedrito and said, Pedrito, what the hell are you doing? Pedrito looked up at me and said, I'm picking up the men and women who are going to the consultation of the 21st. I said, very good, Pedrito, but what the hell do you have in your hands? He said, oh, this is my truck. It's to pick up the men and women. I said, very good, Pedrito, but that is not a truck. That is a pebble, a rock. And Pedrito looked up at me and said, you know, big nose, that is the problem with you Zapatistas. You have no imagination. Beep, 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 todos a la consulta del 21, todos a la consulta del 21. I turned around and looked at La Mar, the ocean, the deepest, wisest of the Zapatistas, and I said, you know, La Mar, that is quite true. We Zapatistas have no imagination. We continued marching into the middle of the Toholabal village, where the men and women of the community were trying to decide who would go to represent them at the consultation of the 21st, when suddenly, above us, a commander-type plane, blue and yellow, began to circle. On the other side, a helicopter from the Mexican army began to hover quite low. The roar and din was deafening. But this did not disturb the community in dialogue. They merely raised their voices and continued forth. But Pedrito, in the middle of the town, looked up and said, Aya, basta. Enough is enough. I'm going to move those things. And zoom, he went into a zoom, and zoom, he came out of his house faster than I've ever seen any child move. And in his hand was a stick. And he said, now watch this. He lifted the stick above his head and went, karoom, karoom, karoom. Suddenly, the commander-type plane, blue and yellow, made a half-circle and headed back toward its base. The helicopter slid away to the edge of the village. Sound returned back to normal. The community continued its dialogue. Pedrito, satisfied with what he had done, threw the stick down and picked up his pebble, his rock. His truck. And off he went. Beep, 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 todos a consulta del 21, todos a la consulta del 21, everybody to the consultation of the 21st. Well, I, being the big nose, I walked over and picked up the stick that Pedrito had dropped. I gave it a scientific viewing, its length, its weight, its texture, its smell, its taste. And I finally turned to La Mar of the Ocean and I said, it's a stick. La Mar of the Ocean said, it's a stick. So I, being the big nose, I put the stick in my pocket and we continued marching out of the Toholabal village, when suddenly we encountered, walking the other way, Comandante Tacho. And Comandante Tacho said, hey, big nose, what the hell do you have in your pocket there? I took out the stick, and then La Mar, the ocean, turned to Tacho and said, it's Mayan technology. Above me, the helicopter that had slid to the edge of the village was right above me, so I decided to see if I could do what Pedrito had done. I lifted the stick above my head and went, garoom, garoom, garoom! Suddenly, the Mexican helicopter turned into a giant tin vulture. It fell straight to the ground. The clouds parted. The sun came out. And the sky became like golden marzipan. Tan, tan. So there, Erica, you have the core of what Mayan technology is and how it functions.
That was unbelievable. Wow. And I just have to backtrack also and ask you about, you've spoken to the military about this before. Did you say that?
Yes, we were invited in 1999 by the National Security Agency, NSA, which is higher than the CIA in terms of its power of secrecy, and we were invited to do a performance for them. It was quite difficult to decide whether we should or not, because we knew that they were going to want to data mine us and certainly, you know, find out how we achieved all this.
Right.
And we did about an hour performance. I had two screens. One was showing Godard's Alphaville, if you remember that. It's a science fiction film about the man who makes a computer cry.
Yes.
And destroys a continued techno society. On the other screen, I had Subcomandante Marcos, the big nose, speaking on the development of the intergalactic network of struggle and resistance and the development of a network of information beyond the dominant media. And then I had a DJ playing music. I wore my Zapatista mask. And then I also had another member of the Electronic Disturbance Theater, Stefan Ray, a scholar and journalist, on the Kafka's podium, reading in a very clear way, point by point, what we had done, how we had done it, why we had done it. And meanwhile, I was telling Zapatista stories, like the one I just told you. They were very angry at us. They didn't enjoy the performance.
Really?
Yeah, they accused us of being the beginning of the electronic Pearl Harbor.
Oh, no.
I told them that they were the beginning of the electronic Pearl Harbor.
No, you are.
And they said, well, we don't know if this is illegal, but it certainly is immoral.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
And I told them that I felt exactly the same way about them. But in my case, I knew that what they had done was completely illegal. So the performance has shifted the discourse of cyber war, cyber terrorism, cyber crime, and also not only because our performance at the NSA was one of the people that we wanted to change their mind was Dr. Dorothy Denning, who is the head of information war for the Clinton government, and she gave a presentation right after our performance at the House Arms Committee, where she says that the Electronic Disturbance Theater and the Zapatistas have developed electronic civil disobedience as part of our long history of civil disobedience from Thoreau to Martin Luther King and others, and it's the equivalent of a Million Mothers March, and it has nothing to do with cyber war, cyber terrorism, or cyber crime. So we thought that was probably the best possible outcome of our performance for the National Security Agency.
Huh. That's pretty amazing. I would have thought that they would know what you would be bringing to them.
You would think, but that's not always the case with the way power works.
Right.
They tend to view things in a very specific, embattled way all the time. And they don't always process the poetic.
Right.
Which is what's important about the radical gesture of art, that it can shift the discussion to a space that they have no language for.
Right.
And so you force them to reprocess their concepts. It's established within, say, the digitally correct community, like hackers. It's established the development of what we call hackerism. Because in the early 90s, when I spoke to hackers, they weren't interested in electronic civil disobedience at all. You know, they thought it was a stupid thing.
Right.
But by 2000, they had invited us to speak about electronic civil disobedience. If you go to any hacker conference nowadays, there's always a section on hacktivism. So I think that's been a very important element of this performance, is that it politicized the hacker community to think about politics of code beyond code. That is, not just to think about what technology politically does for them within the sphere of technology, but to think about what the outcomes of the world outside of code, need in order to, create a better sense of the world, to think about code beyond code.
Yeah, it's almost beyond me, beyond code. It's so much. I mean, it's so much for me to process in all of our emails back and forth. I was like, but isn't that really a performance? And you know, so I can imagine for a group of people that are even outside of the art context, like trying to process, although maybe within the digital context, which I feel like I'm outside of. So it's exciting. It's exciting to hear about your work and other people's work in relation to the digital world.
Yep.
And of course, it's very important. And I mean, of course,
No, I agree, and the language of the gestures that we have created have been very difficult, not only for hackers or military, but also for the art world itself, as well as the performance world.
Right. We just got cut off again. Williamsburg is renowned for its poor signal for the telephone. Oh. And again.
Please leave your message after the tone. Press 1 to send a error page.
All right, I'll try one more time. Hi, Ricardo. It's Erica.
Hey.
I'm in Williamsburg, and the signal here is notoriously non-existent. Almost.
Yeah.
But you were talking about the importance in relation to performance.
I think our performance has, in a certain sense, disturbed a lot of the different trajectories that we're interested in. That is, it took me a long time to convince, say, the performance studies or the performance art community that this was performance.
Right.
It took us a long time to convince the military that this was civil disobedience and not cyber war, not cyber terrorism.
Right.
And it took a while to convince the hackers that they should think about the politics of the world outside of technology in terms of the development of hacktivism.
Right.
So I think it's been an interesting space, and also certainly the art community has been an interesting space to make this manifest,
right.
Such as the Watch What We Say show, which you and I are both a part of, which I think to me is really kind of an interesting space to materialize in, and you know, to have the art community or the material art community also, as of course in your project, start taking into account what is possible for aesthetic culture to develop within these kind of digital zones.
It's exciting, and it's inspiring, like, that you've worked through all of these different communities and that you've had, you know, that you've seen change happen with your work, through your work. And then it's also just very exciting to think about this. For me, I keep thinking about your referencing poetry and like the idea of code in relationship to poetry. And I mean, it seems so important. It seems so important that, you know, poetry be re-injected into everything. But then for me, it's something that I have heard so little about in relation to injecting into the digital. And, you know, it just seems very important.
Yeah, it's always been at the core of my sense of what it meant to be an artist.
Yes.
And that is poesis, what does that type of knowledge, because I believe that art can offer individuals and communities a different type of knowledge that is just as valid as scientific knowledge, as bureaucratic knowledge, as political knowledge, as academic knowledge, I think, and art spaces, like, be they, you know, galleries or museums, are a space where this kind of knowledge can at least be briefly seen and heard, you know, and I think it's something that is often, often a type of knowledge that is easily put under erasure or displaced. That makes sense, because you're off in some little space in Brooklyn.
Yes.
So it's not like you have the convention center, Madison Square Garden to speak.
Exactly.
And what else? There's another piece I've been working with Diane Luton, a really amazing online artist, and Angie Ang, another online artist, called Upload Protest. And I sent you the URL. I don't know it offline right now. I mean, I don't recall URL is.
Is it connected to the Watch What We Say exhibition site?
It isn't. I just sent you the email. It's connected with Postmasters Gallery.
Right. And
NetoMap. Go ahead.
Yes, so if people want to access it, they can access it through the...
And Postmasters.
Uh-huh. Yeah, okay.
Because it's not a part of the Watch What We Say.
Uh-huh.
It's a part of the Postmasters show. And what it is that we use Noikia cameras.
Uh-huh.
And we've been, you know, joining the protest actions and whatnot. And we upload the images that can then be instantly seen within maybe about 30 seconds from us uploading it. Images of the scenes of the protest, as well as text. And you can join the list and share images with us also. And it's part of this idea of anchors for witnessing. That is, that we can use this technology to not only bear witness to the protest, but also do a kind of cop watch where we watch the police and upload any kind of unethical behavior by the powers that be. So we did it very quickly within a couple of days, so it's been kind of haphazard. I wish we could have had more time to plan. But anyway, it's called Upload Protest, and you can go to Postmasters. I'm sure you can find it on any gallery, on any kind of search engine, and find a link to that. And I'm doing that with Diane Luden and Angie Ang. Oh, and can I tell you who the members of Electronic Disturbance Theater are?
Yeah, that would be great.
The other members are Carmen Karasik, an artist up in Boston, Brett Stahlbaum, an artist in San Diego, California, and Stephen Ray, a scholar and activist, a journalist who lives in Austin, Texas.
That's great, and it's exciting to think about that it's a way that you can work with people long distance as well, you know, like that there can be this sort of collaboration happening.
Yeah, well, I've never, Brett Stahlbaum, one of the core members, you know, I've been working with him now for, 5-6 years, and I've never met him.
Wow. That's
I'm going to meet him for the very first time in a couple of weeks.
Wow.
So you have to, in these kind of collaborations, you have to have a virtual faith.
Right.
That there are human beings on the other side of these electronic bodies, and that these human beings share a poetic space with you.
And ultimately, what I would like to come out of this is that the way we can bring our electronic bodies and our real bodies politically and aesthetically together is through the power of poesis, of the poetic.
Well, thank you so much, Ricardo.
Thank you. Thank you, Erica.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, and I hope we will get a chance to meet as well.
Yeah, well, I'm headed to the gallery right now.
Oh,
I don't know if you're there.
I am. So I'll be here.
Okay. Well, I'll be there in a couple of, probably like 20 minutes, because I need to do an interview with somebody there.
Okay, great.
So I'll see you in a while.
Okay, great. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So that was Ricardo Dominguez, one of the artists in the Watch What We Say exhibition, and that was pretty amazing. And I guess I want to ask Carla if there was anything else that you feel like you'd like to add to what you were saying about your performance earlier, before I say my thank yous. And all right. Carla's good. She's reading Robbie Canal's most recent book, Art Burn. And so, thank you. Thank you to everyone who participated in today's program. Maki, Wade, Carrie, Ricardo, Carla, Mary, but without my actually being able to catch a line to talk to her. And thank you to everyone who has helped make this happen for the exhibition. So, Xenia, big thank you to you. Mark, for organizing the exhibition, watching the baby, cheerleading, and then some, cooking dinners. And Carol, for her tireless babysitting. So this has been, it's been a real treat, and I'm a little sad to end today, but also will be excited to have 1 to 3 p.m. back to myself a little bit for a while, and to figure out what Radio Free Erica is going to manifest as next, and it will manifest as next. But remember, do join us tomorrow, Xenia Plechkina and Misha Sklar will be broadcasting, speaking to a couple of people in Russia, and doing some readings and just talking about what they've been up to during this week of the convention. All right, all the best, and thank you, and goodbye.